Hello and welcome to the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast. My name's Christopher Kelly and today I've got not one, but two guests for you today. The first is my 12-year-old nephew, William Chatterton. Hi, William.
Hi.
And the other is one of my more regular guests, Dr. Tommy Wood. Hi, Tommy.
Hi.
We've got kind of an interesting project to do here today. So Wills is doing something for school, and we thought this list of questions that he had for Tommy would make a rather interesting podcast. So maybe you can let me know after the show whether it was interesting for you or not. Certainly the list of questions is very interesting for me. We're going to talk about how diet can affect your cellular health. Cells, I think, are super duper interesting. Like, it kind of, the levels of organization in physiology, it reminds me somewhat of computer science. So at the most basic level, there are atoms and molecules and macromolecules. And then just above that, there are, is the cell. And the cell is the first thing that can sustain life. And the interesting thing about the cell is that that's what we are. We're just 100 trillion cells, a big bag of cells. So when something goes wrong and you walk into the doctor's office, you know, you may be complaining about a migraine or fatigue, but at some level, what you really care about is the cell. So I'm hoping that, you know, the questions that we're going to answer today will be relevant for you. If you're suffering from a problem or if you're trying to improve performance, I think that cellular function and cellular health and how it relates to diet is a really important topic. So what do you think? Should we just dive straight into the first question?
Yeah, sure. So the first question that we have here today is, can your diet affect the starting health of new cells that are constantly growing?
Yeah. Yes, it can.
Next question. No, just kidding. Perhaps you'd like to elaborate further, Tommy.
We're constantly growing cells, regardless of our age. And if you think about when the baby starts in the womb, you basically have to create everything from scratch. But even, you know, now we know that even as you're older, that there are cells all the way throughout the body which are replenished all the time. So the gut is replenished very frequently. There's a very, very rapid turnover, we call it, of cells in the gut. There are certain areas of the brain where even as we get older, we can make new cells. And so we're constantly having to do this. And at the same time, we're also breaking down old cells and getting rid of old junk. And various things we do in the diet can also help us do that. But if you are trying to create new cells, you obviously want all the building blocks that you use to make those cells. So that's going to be various types of fats, proteins, carbohydrates, all those things you talked about. And you want those to be made in the way that you intended, right? So you and I, Chris, have talked a lot about things like, you know, we might measure markers of something like DNA damage. Mm-hmm. And DNA is obviously the main message that's used to tell the cell what it's making. Basically, so that's the code that tells us what's going to be in that cell and how it's going to work. And in order for that to happen, you need the DNA to work properly. And for that to happen, then you need all the sub parts of DNA. But you also need to make sure that DNA doesn't get damaged. And there's many ways that DNA can get damaged. In terms of we talk about, you know, inflammation, oxidative stress, those kind of things that can come in from the. Particularly from the diet. So say if we have a diet that's very high in fats or, you know, oils that we've heated to a high degree to fry things in, then we know that they can cause damage to the DNA, and then you're not going to get the cell to make the proteins you want, so it's not going to function properly. And on a different scale, you might say there are various other things that you need for subparts of the cell, say like the mitochondria, to work properly, and you need to get those from the diet. So another thing might be DHA, which is an omega-3 fat, which we know is very important for the membranes, particularly in the mitochondria, so that they function properly. And if you don't get enough of that, then you get a huge host of downstream effects. So basically, a large part of it comes down to you are what you eat, right? So if you want to make healthy functioning cells, you need to eat and provide all the things that in order to make those cells.
Okay, that's interesting. So how do we avoid... So there's certain types of fats then that you think cause oxidative stress. So how do we identify those and avoid them?
The fat story is really interesting and has multiple different... facets to it, but the simplest way to think about it is the fact that we talk about how saturated a fat is or isn't. So we have saturated fats, and that's basically where you have the length of your fat is made up of carbon molecules, and they are attached to lots of hydrogens and various other things depending on the fat. And if there's no extra space, we call them no extra space for bonds or no double bonds in that fat, then that's saturated. And what's good about that is there's no space for that fat to become damaged. But if you have an unsaturated fat, and that's a fat that has one or more double bonds in it, and those bonds are basically somewhere where there's a possibility that something can come in and break that open. And that creates something called, can create something called a free radical, which is basically an unpaired electron, which then goes and attacks things. And that's part of what we call oxidative stress. So if you have an unsaturated fat, the more unsaturated it is, usually the less stable it is. And then if it's less stable, then you don't want to do things to it that damage it, like heat it up. So one thing we've been told recently is that unsaturated fats, polyunsaturated fats, are very good for us, and they tend to come from vegetable oils if we're taking them in high quantities. And then the first thing we do is we heat them up to 350 degrees and then drop stuff in them to deep fry it. So you can measure the breakdown products of these fats. And we know that the higher the temperature and the longer you heat them for, the more damaged they become. What's interesting is that fats that are in vegetable oils, the omega-6 fats, also when they're in the body, whether they're damaged or not in the first place, when they're being carried around in the proteins that go around in the blood, they're not very well protected. So they're also more likely to then become damaged in some way and then cause problems. That's slightly different from the omega-3 fats, which we hear a lot about in conjunction with seafood. They are also polyunsaturated, but there are actually some proteins that protect them slightly better. So they're, once they're in the body, they're less likely to become damaged than something compared to like an omega-6 fat that you might find from vegetable oils. So you can kind of, if one of the first steps you want to do is try and remove a fat that's going to potentially be harmful in some way, start by removing all those very highly processed oils. And if you are going to use them, don't heat them up. But ideally, you want to probably remove as much of them as possible. If you really want to boil it down, it's don't eat deep fried stuff. Yeah, that gets you a really good part of the way forwards. Did everything I say make sense, Wills?
It did, indeed.
Okay. Can you understand that? It's not that hard to understand, is it? This concept of saturated fat. You can, that doesn't confuse people. Like, you know, and I know there was a drive to say things like white solid fat, because unsaturated and saturated were two bigger words for people to understand. But I think we get it.
Yes. And I know we've already covered this quite a lot, Tommy, but how direct do you believe that the link between cell health and your diet is?
I think it's incredibly direct. Now, if we're going to talk about things that are important for cell health, then food is absolutely up there. One of the most, if not the most important part of the health of your cells. This is something that I try and talk about a lot, is that there are lots of other things that are also important in terms of your exposure to light at the right or wrong time of day, stress, how you sleep properly, you know, making sure you sleep properly, making sure you're part of, the right kind of group, social group, family group, and all of that affects how our genes express and how our cells function. Some people might say it sounds crazy that if you get a little bit stressed, then that can affect the health of your cells. But the downstream effects of long-term high levels of stress really is reduced, you know, reduced function of your cells. So food is incredibly important, but if people focus just on food, then they kind of miss some of the other really important stuff.
And that can be really important, right? That can make or break people. Certainly that was the first thing that I discovered, and I know it's the first thing that a lot of other people discover is the food part, and it makes a huge difference, but it's a bit more complicated than that, right? There's other things that can affect cellular health too, and you can have the best diet in the world, but if you're incredibly stressed out because something bad's happening to you, perhaps you're in a toxic relationship, or perhaps you're completely isolated from a social group or not sleeping well, then that can have just as big an impact as the diet can.
Yeah, and that has like good and bad sides to it, because you know everybody wants just one thing that they can fix and that solves all their problems. And you might say, oh, well, you're not part of like a good social group, and therefore, you know, you're doomed. And then you're like, well, how on earth do I suddenly go out and make all these new friends? And that's difficult. But equally, on the other side, you know, you could spend hours of your day worrying about every single thing that goes in your mouth, or maybe you just go and give your mum a hug. And that, you know, has a similar effect. You know, now I've just gone slightly further up north in Norway with my stepmom and my stepdad and my mum have a house, and the first thing I did is give my mum a hug, and I've done myself a huge load of good. So
every parent listening to this interview is hoping that their kid turns out like you, Tommy. Like, I want him to be a doctor and I want him to help people, and then I want him to earn a PhD, and then I want him to win a Nobel Prize and take down the whole of the medical establishment and show how they're wrong they are. It seems reasonable expectation, don't you think?
I got most of the way along there so far.
you're about three quarters of the way there, I'd say.
Yeah, right. Done the easy stuff.
The next question that we have is, what is the most nutrient-dense meal that you could eat for increased cell health?
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and probably the most nutrient-dense meal that I can think of might not taste very good, because it would probably be some kind of combination of small fatty fish. So you've got lots of, DHA and lots of other micronutrients like selenium and iodine and things like that, and maybe if you had a very small fish like a sardine, then you'd get some of like the skin and bones and stuff in there, and there's lots of collagen and good stuff in there. So maybe some cooked small fish, then maybe something like some eggs with some egg yolks or some liver, and then a good amount of some really dark green leafy vegetables, and preferably some that, you know, have grown out in the wild, because we know that plants that are forced to go and grow out in the wild have more of those things that stimulate our body to have sort of beneficial adaptations. They're probably better than what you might buy in the supermarket. But, you know, supermarket bought kale or spinach or red cabbage, all those things would be good as well. So some of those animal foods and then some of those sort of like plant foods to go with them. That's what I think. But fish plus liver, maybe not everybody's favorite combination.
I'm not sure I ever have either, but you can do it. I definitely have had a salad with some cooked greens in it, and then a can of sardines, and then some liver pate. So Julie makes liver pate quite often. And so I'm pretty close to getting all of those things.
Oh, it's the new surf and turf.
Exactly, new surf and turf. Excellent. That's a really good answer. How about you, Tommy? Do you ever eat anything like that?
I eat a lot of those things, but I've never had them in one meal. Yeah.
Okay.
If I had to go for one single meal, I've never done that. But I'm not particularly squeamish about mixing foods or eating certain foods at certain times of day. So if somebody put that in front of me, I'd definitely eat it.
Yeah, I'm the same actually, and I think it's really helpful, isn't it, to not be, you know, oh well, I couldn't possibly eat that for breakfast, or I can't eat that for lunch. Like, it's, you know, that's really limiting, and getting away from those constraints, I think, is really helpful.
Yeah, when you're trying to sort of overhaul what you eat, and you have this fixed image that everything that at breakfast has to be cereal or toast, or, you know, and it's often, you know, has to be sweet in some way,
right?
You know, that kind of really limits you in terms of the different things that you can eat instead.
Yeah, people get over that really quickly. It's nothing too much to worry about. Okay, well, on to the next question then, Wills.
My next question is, how do you think that the ketogenic diet would affect the cells. So more high fat foods, as you mentioned earlier.
There's obviously both for you, Wills, and anybody who isn't certain at home, there's obviously various different steps that you can take there. So, you know, adding fat into the diet doesn't necessarily make it ketogenic. But, you know, there can often be some benefit there. And often at the same time, you'll be reducing your carbohydrate intake, usually is what you're swapping out in order to add more fat. And that can kind of increase and increase and increase until the point where your carbohydrate, and usually you have to reduce protein intake a little bit, such that some of the fats that you eat, as well as maybe some of the fats that are released from stores in the body, are turned into ketones. And that's what we call a ketogenic diet. And those, so there's multiple facets to a ketogenic diet, and there's definitely a huge amount of research that's suggesting that, even, you know, probably for everybody, and certainly for people with some kinds of diseases, that more or less time eating a ketogenic diet or being in ketosis is a good thing. And the ways that happens, I think, is firstly, often when you go on a ketogenic diet, it's often very similar to something like what Chris eats, which is very low in refined carbohydrates, some protein, some animal foods, and lots of fat, and also lots of vegetables. Not everybody does it, but I think that's always going to be of benefit. And what you've done is you've immediately removed all the crap, right? You've gotten rid of those vegetable oils we talked about. You've gotten rid of the donuts and the pancakes and the bread, and all those things that we know can cause problems with hormone signaling, insulin signaling. And we know that if particularly in probably, say, in combination with somebody who's also, you know, got all those other lifestyle factors we talk about, if they're doing those things wrong as well, then those very, you know, big swings in blood sugar can affect the way the proteins in our body work and all those kinds of things. So we've taken those things out. And then also, if you're in ketosis, then what you see is in the short term, very interestingly, is you probably get an increase in oxidative stress, particularly in the mitochondria, which are like the powerhouse of the cell, we call them, because that's where they make ATP. That's the kind of, that's the energy currency for our cells. And in the short term, maybe within the first, you know, 1 or 2 weeks, when you're in ketosis, you have an increase of oxidative stress. And everybody's always taught that oxidative stress is a bad thing. You think, you know, we talked about those free radicals, they can go and damage stuff. But actually, reactive oxygen species are also, they act as signaling molecules within the cells. So they kind of tell the cell to do different things. And you need some, but then it's like the Goldilocks effect. So none is bad, just enough is good, and then too much is bad again. And so what happens is that increases, and then the cell adapts to it. And then you actually get an increase in lots of things that make your mitochondria function, that allow you to then adapt or absorb oxidative stress from other places. So kind of the way the ketogenic diet works is probably on multiple facets, and, you know, and probably even on ones that I haven't mentioned or that we don't know about yet. But it usually comes from both improving the quality of the diet, and then ketones can do all kinds of things like downgrade inflammation or inhibit inflammation, and then, you know, boost the way that our mitochondria work, make them more efficient, which is making, you know, creating a healthy population of mitochondria that are all very similar and all function together is probably, you know, the goal of all of the stuff we're trying to do in order to become healthier.
So you're saying that in the beginning, the ketogenic diet may cause more oxidative stress. But later on, once you become adapted to the diet, there may be less.
Yeah, so that's what we see from animal studies, certainly, when we put them on a ketogenic diet. In the short term, because you'll see some people say a ketogenic diet is bad for you because you get an increase in oxidative stress. And in the short term, that seems to be true, at least from most of the animal studies. But then there's an adaptation. You get an upregulation of lots of genes to do with antioxidant handling. So more glutathione, more ability to then absorb those stresses, and an improvement in mitochondrial function. So there's definitely if you consider oxidative stress to be purely a bad thing, then the ketogenic diet might turn out to be overall bad. But in reality, it's probably a stressor in the short term that gives your body a beneficial adaptation later on.
And then, so just to kind of ask that same question, just tell me what to do. What should I do? Do you think everybody should be eating a ketogenic diet, or do you think that's a bad idea?
I don't think everybody should be eating the ketogenic diet, and certainly not all the time. There are some other things that happen. Your electrolytes, so your sodium and your potassium and other things like selenium, they become harder to hold onto. So people can become deficient in those things on a ketogenic diet. It can also, if you have problems with other hormonal signaling things, then the extra stress of the diet can be a problem. But I think if we were all going to have a scenario where we're functioning optimally, we should spend periods of time in ketosis, either through just complete fasting or restricting carbohydrate, and then also spend more time eating higher levels of carbohydrate. And if we really want to take it one step further, we might want to do it in line with how we found foods in nature previously. So the way people like to think about that is, in the winter, you're probably eating meat, animals, whatever, you know, you managed to hunt, you know, whatever was hibernating in the cave next door and you managed to kill while it was sleeping or whatever. And then in the summer, then you've got more access to carbohydrates because, you know, fruit grows on the trees and you know, berries on the grounds and things like that. So you might even be that the best way to do it is to time that with the seasons. And we talk about seasonal food, but then, you know, everybody just buys what's in season in a country on the other side of the world. So it could be that the optimal thing will be to time all those things together, and that will kind of tie together a lot of the problems that we think people are having.
Excellent. Well, did you have any other questions, Wills, for that about the ketogenic diet? Are you sold on it? Are you going to start eating a very high fat, low carbohydrate, moderate protein diet anytime soon?
Well, in my household, we do tend to eat quite a high fat diet. We don't eat gluten and we don't, we have less dairy than everybody else, so almost but not quite.
And that's fine, Wills. I'm sure you guys are doing it just right.
I think so too. Why don't we move on to the next question then, Wills?
So more on the path of like past and major events in how we've changed and how we ate. Our next question is, what happened to our food and diets between the Paleolithic era and what you might call today the food pyramid?
Yeah, so this is something that is still a very hot topic of debate. And actually, there's a lecture here in Oslo by somebody next week that I'm going to go to, which is basically the title of the talk is something like, it's basically rubbishing people who are talking about the food that we ate as we evolved and using that to inform how we should eat now. And they've decided that that's a whole bunch of nonsense. So I'm going to go and see what they've got to say. So it's still, this is still something that's hotly debated. And a lot of it is to do with, say, carbohydrates. So how many carbohydrates we had access to and when we started to eat them. And this particularly ties into when we started using fire. And when you have fire, then there are then you can cook things. And when you can cook things, there are more things that you can eat. And there's definitely part of the thought process is that the reason we evolved the way we did is because when we started to get access to fire, then we could cook food and get so much more out of it than we could before. And a large part of that is again DHA that I talked about earlier. So we think that some of it came maybe from people who live near the sea and could get access to fish. But we also know from some research that people have done more recently is that if a tribe didn't live anywhere near the sea, then they managed to get their DHA other ways. And the way they did that is from the brains of animals. And if they didn't have access to big animals, then they'd go down to the villages of the people who did have access to fish, and they'd eat their brains because their brains would be full of DHA. So there's definitely That was definitely very important. And cooking meat was probably part of that because it helped us, you know, digest it and get the most out of what we were eating. And then the typical storyline is that around 10,000 years ago, we became agriculturalists. So we started farming. Basically, we learned how to grow and cultivate seeds and grasses like wheat. And in a lot of places, immediately after we did that, our health, so if you look at in one region of, just you can take any region in the world where you have a fossil record that has people before and after the onset of the agricultural revolution, we call it, or people just basically starting farming and then basing most of their diet off what they could grow. And that was often wheat and, you know, large volumes of carbohydrates from that one source. And often when you see that and you have that direct comparison, you see that people got shorter, and they seem to have worse, you can see from their teeth, they have worse dental health and some other problems. And they maybe had more infections and things like that. And there's, you know, we can't say that that was definitely the cause. And I think part of it is not just the fact that wheat is evil necessarily and nobody should eat it, but it's the fact that when you only...
Can I just interrupt you there and say that wheat is evil and nobody should eat it?
Fine, I'm just joking. And plenty of people believe that. And I think for a lot of people, and probably more people than some people say, they just shouldn't eat wheat. There's no benefit from it. I don't think there's any benefit from it. But how evil it is for everybody is a matter of debate. We'll put it that way. I don't think you gain very little from it. Probably nothing. And it may even be harmful. For a good proportion of people. But I think what the real problem is that when you learn how to cultivate wheat and you used to spend all your time scratching in the mud for tubers and foraging berries and going out and hunting whatever animal it was you hunted, you know, all of a sudden the food just turns up right in front of you, right? So then all you eat is that. And I think then that becomes a problem. So whether, you know, the wheat on its own was a big problem or whether it, you know, you completely change the way that people approach food. And then I think that becomes a big part of the issue. So around, you know, as we sort of went from the Paleolithic into the Neolithic era, then we know that, you know, people started farming and we had a lot of crops and, you know, a lot of them were sort of grains and were grain based. And then much more recently, if you're talking about the food pyramid, so in the 1980s or 1980 was when you had the first dietary guidelines in the US. And then the base of the pyramid was again grains. And there's a huge amount of debate about why this was, but part of it was because you had what was still, you know, a relatively poor country, and it was not that. And so this, even in the run-up to the formalized food guidelines, when people were being advised to eat things, grains were said to be the staple because it was something that the government could easily subsidize and could then be provided cheaply to a very large population. So it wasn't necessarily based on convenience rather than for optimal health. And there were some other things like people thought that saturated fats were bad, and that kind of lent itself to people moving towards that kind of diet. And then at the same time, obviously since the 1980s, if you know, since those dietary guidelines came into play, we've had, you know, around that time and maybe 10 years before, people were, because of the saturated fat story, we're talking a lot more about polyunsaturated fats because they can, if you eat a lot of vegetable oils, your cholesterol comes down. And we thought that, you know, cholesterol was bad and caused heart disease. Therefore, polyunsaturated fats are good for you. That was the way it was sold. But because for a number of different reasons we talked about earlier, vegetable oils, polyunsaturated fats can be bad. And I really think that kind of killer combination of a high processed carbohydrate intake plus vegetable oils and plus, you know, more and more refined sugar, which is part of that sort of carbs deal. And at the same time, you know, we're not eating all that good stuff from that we talked about from animals, those nutrient dense foods. We don't eat those. We don't really eat any plants. We don't eat any vegetables. And so there's been this huge shift from those foods that we used to have to go out and, you know, really work hard to get, to this sort of really, you know, sort of really detrimental mix of nothing that just doesn't really, it's not really useful to you in any way other than the fact that it is calories. So I think that, you know, I think it's 70 to 80% of the calories in the Western world come from wheat, corn, and soya. And that's what we eat, that kind of beige processed food. And as soon as you think about that, you realize why, you know, why we're in so much trouble.
Just another question here. Do you think that the food pyramid would be changed soon? Or
so, you know, there's a huge number of people who are working really hard to try and get that done. And there's a big movement in the US, and there's a movement that's just starting to be put together by some good friends of mine in the UK, and they're trying to do something similar. And I think it's incredibly important but it's not necessarily important because it won't change the way people eat. I don't really believe that people eat according to the food pyramid, but I believe that the food pyramid is used to create the foods that we then eat, because then you can say that this is high in healthy whole grains and healthy vegetable oils because that's what the food pyramid says. So I think, I don't know anybody who looks at the food pyramid and says, well, do you know what? I haven't had my base today of grains, therefore I can't move up to the next step or level of the pyramid. I don't really think anybody thinks like that, but it all kind of informs the food that is created and then put in front of us. So I think it is really important, but there are a large number of people who are also working really hard from the other side. And there's a number of reasons there, almost all large countries, particularly in the Western world, heavily subsidize their farming. And that is largely crops and then also dairy. So there's a huge, you know, there will always be a huge pushback from any kind of industry that is heavily subsidized by the government. So if you then want to say, if the government guidelines change overnight to say that people shouldn't eat grains, you know, there would be complete and utter uproar, both, you know, from every level, from the farmer himself, because obviously his income is going to be slashed. And that is an incredibly important, you know, that's an incredibly important thing that we need to take into consideration. You know, I don't want this guy to starve. But, you know, then there's also all those people who make the food that you can make out of, you know, wheat and corn and soy, which is most of the food that we eat today. So there's a huge number of vested interests, and then also a number of nutritionists who have decided that things are the way that they are and they should be and should stay, and that anybody who doesn't listen to them, you know, they're the expert and you have to listen to them, and anybody who doesn't listen to them is full of shit. And, you know, while they're in positions of power, their kind of hubris is gonna stop us being able to make any changes. So the long answer to your question is people are trying, but I'm not sure it's gonna happen anytime soon. But they have recently, in the US, they recently changed the guidelines to reduce the wording surrounding saturated fat, and, you know, so, you know, taking away that thing suggesting that it's bad for us and we should be really cutting it out or really reducing it in our diets. And they've also removed dietary cholesterol. So, you know, things like eggs have a good amount of cholesterol in, and they've removed the caution there that eating those might be bad for you. So, you know, baby steps.
So just recently, well, maybe a week ago, on your website, you released a couple of talks from Iceland, and some of the answers and questions were based around the Terry Walls diet. Approach. And what is your personal opinion on that?
Okay, so you're talking particularly about one talk I gave about multiple sclerosis, which is Terry Wall's area of interest. And it's also the area that I came into this whole scene with. Terry Wall's has kind of become, you know, she is essentially you know, dramatically improved her health and reversed her multiple sclerosis, largely through diet and also some other things. Like, she does some electrical, she had to do some electrical stimulation of her muscles to kind of get her strength back so that she could get out of her wheelchair. And, you know, I'm a huge, huge fan of the, of her diet. And the reason why is, when I talk about multiple sclerosis, I talk about what we did. So I come, I have a family of chemical engineers. My stepbrother has MS, and my stepfather is a chemical engineer. And all he knows how to do is make models of problems to try and solve the problem, right? That's what chemical engineers do, probably better than anybody else in the world. They're problem solvers. That's what they're taught to do. So we basically built this huge model of multiple sclerosis to try and find out what the causes were. And one of the things that's really important is diet. And, you know, that comes in two parts. So it's take out the things that are bad and putting in the things that are good. And what that ends up looking like is very similar to a paleo style diet. People with MS have, almost always have, an inappropriate reaction to grains, particularly gluten and dairy, particularly casein protein, but also some other proteins in dairy. But you also just have, say, mitochondria that really aren't working properly. So you need to give them all the things that they need to work properly. And so then what it ends up looking like is a lot like a paleo diet. And then, you know, there are other things that you can do. You can take out some other problem foods. And I know that Terry Walls's approach, you know, towards the end, moves towards some periods in ketosis, because that's really important for brain health and brain function, is getting some ketones to the brain if in the diseased state. And so the reason why I'm a big fan of her approach is because it's very similar to what we found, but we did it in two very different ways at a very similar time. So, you know, if two groups of people answer the same, you know, get the same answer to the same problem using different methods, you know, I really think that sort of bolsters the evidence behind it. So that's why, you know, so I always mention her work at the end of my talks, because we give very, very similar advice. And I think it's really important to show people that, you know, lots of people have asked this question. And if you come up with the same answer, then I think it's really, you know, that really increases the credibility or the likelihood that what we found is right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you mind if I jump in here, Wills? I'm going to steal your next question, because I can't help myself. So do you think that Terry Walls did any of this work for herself, or do you think she's just highlighted other people's research and ideas?
Yeah, so when I read this question before, I thought, you know, it's such a good question, and I think it's so important about in this whole kind of area. In reality, there's the quote that there's nothing new under the sun. Right. So every idea that you have, somebody else has had already. Now, they may have not acted on that idea, but that idea has already come and gone. And, you know, I really fight this in myself all the time, because I often think, I've had this really, really good idea and I don't want to tell anybody about it, because then they might steal it and do something with it. You know, I think that's just a very natural human reaction. But I also, you know, probably every idea somebody else has had, they just haven't applied it in some way. Or maybe I had this idea, but I actually heard it from somebody else, then forgot about it, and then thought I came up with it by myself. And the important thing is that, yes, so Terry Walls has taken a huge amount of research and used it and is then applying it to other people. But if all those ideas weren't being used in the way that she's now using them, or they hadn't been properly applied, you know, she's the first person who's applying all these different principles in patients with multiple sclerosis in clinical trials. So you could say that by, you know, she tinkered with all this and used it on herself. So she learned from other people. She gathered other people's ideas. She used herself as a guinea pig. And then, you know, is now applying it to other people. So yes, you know, I think every person who's in the health field, most other fields, has taken ideas from other people and just built upon them. So I think it really depends on how you look at the question. So did she have any like super novel research that she did by herself? No, not really. But she's achieving incredible things by putting together a program based on all these ideas that kind of answer the question as a whole. So yes and no.
She's not the only one, right? So I had tremendous results eating according to the autoimmune paleo protocol, which I don't believe was invented by, but certainly was popularized by Sarah Ballantyne, or the paleo mom. And it's the same thing all over again. Did she start this stuff from scratch? No, but she did a tremendous amount of work and produced an excellent book that popularized the diet. And in doing so, she's helped a tremendous number of people.
Absolutely. So what do you think is the most helpful piece of simple advice that you could give about customizing the Terry Walls protocol personally for people's everyday lives?
Okay, so if we're applying the Terry Walls approach to everybody, say, you know, not just people with multiple sclerosis.
Yeah.
Okay. What this would look like generally is a very high plant, high fat, fairly low carbohydrate, paleo style diet. So no grains, no legumes, no dairy. Terry Walls is really big on vegetables. So she says you should have, a third of your vegetables should be dark green leafy vegetables, a third should be colorful vegetables, and a third should be sulfur-based vegetables or cruciferous vegetables for lots of various different reasons. And lots of them are to do with cellular function. But if you are just the average person who is then trying to find something that's sustainable for a long period of time, there's a possibility that it can be restrictive. And I think it's only restrictive if you think of it as restrictive and actually you can find a way to make it as varied and as exciting as you want. But that just takes a little bit of work on the front end. But that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody needs to eat like that. And I think the best way to start is to start with the basic diet and then reintroduce things. And people might want to reintroduce some dairy. They might, if they're on an autoimmune style diet, an autoimmune paleo diet, then that excludes eggs. Maybe they want to start by reintroducing eggs, particularly egg yolks. I'd start with egg yolks and then egg whites, as people are more likely to be sensitive to the whites than the yolks. And then, you know, give yourself some time, bring it back in and see how you feel. And if you ever, you know, don't feel quite right after bringing your food back in, then maybe that's something that you shouldn't, you know, eat anymore. It's probably just not doing you that much good. So I think the best way to do it is to, particularly when people struggle with health problems and not just multiple sclerosis, but I'd always recommend, and I know that's what Chris does too, is you just start with the basic exclusion diet and then you tinker from there and you pick something, maybe something that's less likely to be problematic. So a lot of people might have problems with large quantities of grains. So maybe you introduce that later than something like eggs or dairy. And you just try it and see how you go. And the problem is that it's a simple answer. So the answer is, eliminate and then reintroduce stuff and see how you feel. Like that's a pretty simple answer, but it can take a fair amount of time and requires you to kind of know your body and kind of see how it affects you. So the answer is simple, but everybody needs to realize that it's going to take some time to figure it out, which is fine. You know, I think we spend a lot of, you know, we have a lot of problems because we're completely disconnected from the food that goes in our mouths. So maybe spending a bit more time thinking about it is a good thing. Spending too much time thinking about it is a bad thing. So again, you can go too far, but I don't think most people go far enough.
Yeah, I can tell you, Wills, what I see people achieve in practice. And so this is the way that I did it. And this is the way I'd recommend anyone listening do it is, say you've got a problem, a specific problem that you're trying to address. Well, our scientific or maybe unscientific intuition is just to remove things one at a time. But the problem with that, it just takes too long and that there's too many interfering factors. And so what I think works better is just to be really strict for a period of, say, 30 or even 60 days, just eliminate everything. So the Walls protocol gives in detail the list of foods which are likely to be problematic, the things that you should and shouldn't eat. And so you stick to that. You're super strict for a period of 2 months. And then you get to this place where you're like, you know what? I feel awesome. And then you can start reintroducing things one at a time. And then at that point, it's much easier to figure out which particular foods might be a problem for you. So, for example, I was speaking to someone recently who like never thought they had a problem with nuts until they eliminated them for 2 months and then tried reintroducing them. And at that point, they were feeling so good and they had such an exquisitely sensitive sense of how they were feeling, that they knew that the nuts, you know, just didn't agree with them for whatever reason. Maybe they just felt a little bit more tired or had a bit of brain fog or something like that. And so, you know, they didn't really like nuts that much anyway. And so now they just don't really eat them anymore. And I don't think anything as bad is going to happen by them eliminating nuts for an extended period. But I think you understand, like, kind of that you have to go through this process of total elimination and then reintroduction at the afterwards. The next question is, and I'm going to ask it, are there any other diets apart from the Walls protocol that could produce the same result?
Yes, there are. There are diets that have been used very successfully, according to the research done by the people that looked into them. And the main one that I know that, I don't know, Wills, that you've maybe seen it, and Chris and I, you and I have talked about it, is the diet put together by a physician called Roy Swank, the Swank diet. And if you look at all the research, actually historically the most successful diet for multiple sclerosis is his diet. You know, he worked on the most patients and, you know, gave most of the diet and followed them up, and you know, compared to, say, Terry Walls, who started very recently and doesn't have that much data yet, it's the best published diet for multiple sclerosis. And the problem is, if we call it a problem, is that it's a very low fat and fairly low animal product diet. It's much closer to something like a very low fat vegan or vegetarian diet. But things like dairy are okay as long as they're very low fat, because part of the theory there was that saturated fat was causing part of the problems. There are many issues with this. So he saw a benefit in his patients, but, you know, so basically the stricter you were with the diet, the better you did. And this was back in the time, when, you know, it wasn't randomized controlled trials. Everybody went on the diet, sort of improve it. You know, when you go on any diet, you always improve the quality of your diet, which is important. You are actively engaging in your own treatment, which always has a positive effect. And, you know, we had no control group, and, you know, there were lots of other, you know, things that confound it. And when we think about maybe some of the processes that underlie multiple sclerosis, including problems with cellular function, then I think the way that Terry Walls approaches it is much more intuitive to me in terms of actually fixing those problems than something like the Swank diet. And people have been doing some research on the Swank diet recently, and I'm not sure they've published any papers. I certainly haven't seen any, but I've seen some preliminary results, and they weren't particularly impressive. If we look at the data that's out there, the true published data on diets that help multiple sclerosis, the Swank diet is the best published and supposedly the most successful. And it obviously does have some benefits. You know, I truly believe that he saw improvement in his patients. Why that's the case, I'm not sure. And whether that's the best diet possible for multiple sclerosis patients, I don't think that that's true.
So you think there might be some confounding factors here then, that Swank was getting the patients to do something in addition to the diet?
No, I think the diet has, you know, had some benefits, you know. So it's still an improved diet quality over what people were probably eating before. Because, you know, almost any diet that works, usually you remove a bunch of stuff that probably isn't very good for you. And that was still the case in the Swank diet, because it's still, you know, largely a whole foods based program. And I think there's some benefit there. Whenever anybody does anything to try and improve their health, and with any kind of diet study, you can't have a blinded, you know, your patients can't be blinded. They know what they're eating, right? You can't prevent that. It's not like some anonymous pill that you could give them a placebo or give them the drug. You can't do that. So that's one of the real problems, is that, you know, these people, they were all seeing, they see Roy Swank. He tells them he's got this great diet. It's going to help them. And it does help them. And part of that is because they're engaging the process. Part of that is that they've improved the quality of their diet. And, you know, there are lots of other potential things that could be going on. But I think it did have benefit. You know, I believe that if people with multiple sclerosis went from eating a standard Western diet and started eating the Swank diet, I'm certain it would help them. But I I don't necessarily think that it's the best possible choice.
Right, right. No, that makes sense. Well, the next question is a really good one. So why didn't you go ahead and ask it, Wills?
So if the Terry Walls or Swank diet even was so successful at slowing or even curing multiple sclerosis, and I know there's other diets that can treat certain medical issues, then should doctors recommend dietary subscriptions more?
Yes, they should. I absolutely think they should. But unfortunately, at the moment, that comes with a number of caveats. So the first one is that doctors aren't taught anything about nutrition. And we hear that, you know, in the, we'll call them the alternative health communities, which is what, you know, the low carbohydrate community or the paleo community, you know, which they are, the alternative health communities. And I spend a lot of time there, but I'm also a traditionally trained doctor. And, you know, traditionally trained doctors get a real bad, they get a real bad time in those groups. You know, we're constantly told how we know nothing about nutrition and how, you know, we're all useless and all this kind of stuff. And part of that problem is we're just not really taught any about any of this stuff. And equally, part of why we're not taught about any of this stuff is because at the moment, this kind of era, we'll call it an era of what we call evidence-based medicine, which is that everything that you have to do as a doctor has to be fully backed by 10 randomized controlled trials of 1,000 people each. And, you know, the treatment you're giving is the best one possible. And the problem is that when it comes to dietary stuff, it's just never going to happen. Like all the, you know, we have very short term studies that you can do very intensely, but they're very expensive with not very many people, and you don't know how that lasts for a long period of time. Or you can look at what people eat over a long period of time and look at their health, but that doesn't really tell you anything about whether it was the diet that caused those problems. It just sort of, or you know, or prevented diseases. It just kind of gives you some ideas. So the studies that the medical community wants in order to have the evidence to prescribe different diets to people with different diseases, I don't think they're ever going to happen. You know, nobody has the money for those studies. They're just not going to happen. So I do think that these diets and different diets for different conditions do help people, and you see it very frequently. And there's always, you know, in the patient in front of you, there's always a confounding factor, and it comes down to, you know, they're taking, you know, active engagement in their health. You know, there's no control group. There could be doing lots of other things at the same time that might be helping them. So, you know, somebody will always say that the evidence isn't good enough. And I think that's really going to hold us back from being able to truly prescribe diets to people.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important topic. And it's like a double-edged sword, isn't it? The evidence-based medicine, that it's such a powerful tool, but in this respect, it might actually be holding everyone back.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really, I think it's really important when you're trying to bring a new, say, drug to the scene. You know, there's lots of, you know, funny statistical stuff you can do to kind of make a drug seem better. So nowadays, when you bring a new drug to the market, it's usually to replace another drug that's gone off patent, or often to replace another drug that's gone off patent. So you're not making any money from it anymore. And what you do in a clinical trial is you look for something called non-inferiority, which basically means that your new drug isn't any worse than your old drug, rather than showing superiority, which means that your new drug is better than your old drug. But if you have a new drug and it's got loads of, and you show non-inferiority, so that doesn't mean it's even the same as, it means that based on the statistics you have, it's probably not worse. That's all you're saying. But then you have this new drug and you have, you know, the advertising that goes into it, and you sell it to the doctors, and it becomes a new thing. So, you know, in that kind of world, if you're bringing, you know, drugs to medical treatment, I think it is very important to have randomized controlled trials. It needs to be really rigorously tested, and you need to make sure it's safe to give to lots of people. And so then I think it's really important. You're right. But, you know, when it comes to more complex things like diet and lifestyle, you just can't control that stuff, you know, because it's a person at the end of the day, and you can control a pill that they take in the morning with their breakfast. But what they do for the other, like, 23 hours, 59 minutes and 59 seconds of the day. It's impossible.
Right. So there's no way to isolate the variable that you're interested in the same way as you can do with some novel molecule.
Exactly.
So my next question was, why don't doctors prescribe certain food to their patients, as some are known to have medicinal properties? But I think we've already covered that enough, so I'll move on to the next, which is, what can you recommend for any small changes to an everyday diet and lifestyle?
I think this is something that I've mentioned sort of throughout, and Chris has mentioned throughout, and we can probably just summarize it very nicely. Just eat real food. Like, it's as simple as go to this, and I know that for some people that becomes very complicated because maybe they don't have, you know, the time to cook, or they're not used to cooking, you know, as is more and more common. But in reality, it's just, you know, going out, even if it's going to your local grocery store and, you know, just picking actual ingredients, vegetables, fish, meat, eggs, you know, could be nuts, you know, anything like that, single ingredient stuff, and just turning it into food. And simply by doing that, you remove all of the stuff that we talked about earlier, and you don't even then need to worry about, you know, gluten and dairy and strict paleo and all that stuff. I don't think most people need to worry about that. I think if you just start by, you know, going and finding real food, and, you know, even better if you can go to a local farmer's market and talk to the guy that you know reared the sheep that was killed and then gave to you. And I think, you know, connecting with that local environment is really good, but some people don't have access or the money or for that, and that's fine too. So just eating real food, and then getting enough sleep, spending time with people you love and who love you, and not worrying about the things you can't control, like, and moving every day, like walk a lot, occasionally lift some heavy stuff. Like, if you do all of that, I really don't think there's anything, you know, and all of those steps require a lot of input from you. So I won't pretend that it's easy, but if you do all of those things, I really don't, and you do a lot of it outdoors as well. I think that's really important. You know, connecting with the, you know, getting the right light at the right time is very important. So if you do all of that stuff, then I think that's really the key to everything. Does that help? Is that far too complicated?
No, it's not that complicated. The just eat real food message is pretty simple to understand, and I think it's an important one. Well, this has been great. I quite enjoyed this. Did we answer all your questions satisfactorily, Wills?
Yes, you did. Really well.
When I say we, I mean did Tommy answer your questions satisfactorily? And I think the answer is yes. Yeah. Thank you so much, Tommy.
Oh, it's a huge pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for, you know, I'm honored to be asked to be part of it. So thank you.